I think that the place to begin is with a general introduction. And so just to give you some sense, not by any means the full scope of critical and introductory issues that are usually treated in the context of a seminary class on the book of Revelation, but I do want to give the main items that are usually discussed ad infinitum so that you get some idea of the challenges that you encounter the moment you start delving into this book. So let's go ahead and begin. Time is kind of short for us, so maybe towards the end of each session, if there is a question or two, I'll try to answer it. Not guaranteeing that I'll give you a satisfactory answer. If I don't know the answer, I'll try to bring the answer the following week. But let's begin then with an introduction. So if you'll move the sheet forward here. I'd like to just say a word about authorship, the author of the book of Revelation. I know that all of us, or maybe 99.9% of us here, believe it was written by the Apostle John. I believe it was written by the Apostle John. Nevertheless, there have been a number of scholars across history that have proposed that it was probably somebody else who wrote it other than the Apostle John. So for example, somebody will take a passage like Revelation 21:14. Notice how it reads, "And the wall of the city had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb." That suggests to some people that whoever wrote this apocalypse couldn't have been an apostle, because he's speaking of the apostles as if he himself isn't one of them. When we take the time to review the theories and the different ideas about who the author was, some have followed Papias, who speaks of the author as John the Elder, and suggests that the elder was someone other than John the Apostle. Again, if this elder was indeed the apostle, you would think he would call him John the Apostle rather than John the Elder. Perhaps he's calling him the elder to distinguish him from John the Apostle. These are by any means the only issues that enter into the discussion whenever we're trying to come to a reasonable understanding of who the writer was, but these are issues that continue to pop up along history as we debate that issue. For myself and for a good number of scholars in the world, there's every reason to believe that John the Apostle is the author. John was familiar with Palestinian history and geography. He knew the lay of the land, and so this gentleman does also. Besides that, Justin Martyr, 165 AD, Clement of Alexandria, Hippolytus, and Origen, along with others, all support the view that John the Apostle was the original author. So we also have first and second century testimony strengthening the view and the position that the author of this book was indeed one of the 12 apostles. So we're going to follow along on the basis of that understanding. Because at the end of the day, whether you believe it was John or maybe some elder named John, I don't think it changes much the way we understand or interpret the book of Revelation. Let's talk about date. When was the book of Revelation written? And on this issue, there's also plenty of debate. Some people hold to an early date for the writing of the book of Revelation. And those who hold to an early date usually date it sometime in the mid-60s, between 64 and 68 AD. during Nero's reign. There's a number of sources in antiquity that say the book was written during the reign of Nero. And interesting, the Monarchian prologue, written in 250 to 350 AD, within that time frame, claimed that Paul wrote to seven churches following the pattern of John's example in Revelation. Now think about it. If that's true, we know that John wrote in the mid to late 50s and early 60s. So if John wrote in a pattern similar to what we have in the book of Revelation, then the book of Revelation had to have existed prior to that, which would make the book of Revelation having been written even much earlier than this date that we have here. Some of the things that we have to contend with. That's a bust of Nero, by the way. There is also a later date. For example, believing that the book was written sometime in the mid-90s during Domitian's reign. Irenaeus was one who lived in the late 2nd century, and he says that the book of Revelation was written toward the end of Domitian's reign, sometime between 81 and 96 AD. Well, I don't think the scholarly world has arrived at a consensus as to date. What I can tell you is that if you are a preterist, and I'll talk a little bit about what a preterist is here, not a predator, but a preterist. We'll talk about that in a bit. But if you subscribe to a preterist perspective, then you tend to opt for an early date, okay? Believing that the book of Revelation was written during the reign of Nero, or perhaps Vespasian, who came after him. However, if you subscribe to a later date, then you tend to be a futurist, and you would more likely believe that the book was written during the time of Domitian. One of the reasons for subscribing to the later date is that while Nero persecuted Christians, his persecution seems to have been local, whereas the book of Revelation lays out the possibility or the idea of a broader-based persecution. And that really didn't happen under Nero. It happened more under Domitian than it did under Nero or Vespasian. So there are reasons then to consider these two date possibilities, and really it makes the interpretation of the book of Revelation tremendously different if you subscribe to the date, to the idea that the book was written early in the sometime in the 60s or later sometime in the 90s. And we'll see that as we continue to move along. The book of Revelation, I think, can be, the literary nature of the book of Revelation, I think, can be seen from three different perspectives. On the one hand, it clearly has an epistolary character. There are many elements within it that suggest it was written within within the frame of an epistle. So, for example, Revelation 1:4, John to the seven churches that are in Asia, grace to you and peace. That is a typical salutation that you would find in Paul's letters, for example, in the New Testament. Now, there are other passages there that I put out for you, all to show basically that this revelation wasn't just a manifestation that comes to John as an epiphany, although there are those elements clearly in it as well. But whatever he received, he was to send it to the churches in the way he would send a letter of the time. So it has those clear features that frame this amazing revelation within the framework of a letter, a typical letter of the first century AD. The book of Revelation is written to specific churches in Asia. We see those churches in Revelations 2 and 3. We'll have more to say about those later. And so, again, this wasn't just written and, you know, and given to the wind to carry originally. It wasn't just written and thrown out to the wind to carry it to the four corners of the earth, but was originally directed and sent to seven churches specifically. So it has that that character going for it. Next. But it also has a prophetic character. This is what is interesting to me, because I believe that John the Apostle wrote, or was the agent that God used to pen this book of Revelation. Yet, I mean, the way I kind of think of it, it's almost as if, well, it's not almost, it's God telling John, I know you're an apostle, but I want you to put your apostolic credentials down for a moment, and I want you to assume the posture of a prophet. I want you to speak as if you were a prophet. And you can see those passages in the book of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 3, 22, 7, 22, 9, and 10, 22, 18, and 19. There are other places as well. But in every one of those passages, the author, we find that the passage is speaking about the author, but it's not speaking about him from an apostolic perspective, but rather from a prophetic perspective. Okay? So that we have here what I think is the setting us up for the third characteristic, which is apocalyptic, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But by bringing these prophetic credentials to the forefront, okay, it's as if God is saying, I'm speaking to Israel. Now, some of us here might not be so quick to head down in that direction, but all of us have the prerogative to be right or wrong. 99% of, I shouldn't say 90, maybe 80% of prophecy in the Old Testament is directed at either Israel, the northern tribes, or Judah, the southern kingdom. There are a few prophets that address the pagan nations, but by and large, they address the nation of Israel in her infidelity or in whatever issues she is facing at the time. Because prophets had that distinct ministry to the nation of Israel, I believe that this prophetic element in the book of Revelation is kind of a revival of that. That there comes a moment, or there will come a time, if you're a futurist, there will come a time when God will again speak prophetically to this nation that he chose for a particular purpose and a very specific reason. This isn't to say that the book of Revelation has nothing to say to the Gentile nations, the people other than Jews, but it is to say, in my estimation, that the lion's share of the message is definitely directed towards Israel. Either in the 60s, if you're a preterist, across history, if you're a historicist, or at some future time, if you're a futurist. So this prophetic element, I think, is a revival and an echo that takes us back to how prophets function in the Old Testament. Somehow, this prophetic office is being brought to the forefront here and being reintroduced for a new day, whatever that day might be. Let's look at the third characteristic, and the book of Revelation is also apocalyptic. Apocalypticism, there are different ways to describe it. The way I think about it is this, that once the prophets waned, once the proliferation of prophets gave way in Israel to where there comes a day when there are no more prophets in the land, Israel longed for the prophetic voice. They hadn't listened to them when they were around, not necessarily. But now that they're gone, they wish they were back, because that would be a sure indication that God was still dealing with them and speaking to them in an authoritative way. Well, what do you do? What do you do if the prophetic voice is silent or scarce in the land? Apocalypticism is a genre that emerged sometime between 200 BC and continued for about 300 or 400 years into 200 AD, where Jews would write so as to evoke the hope and the expectation that sometime in the future, God will yet again speak to us with this kind of authority and in this kind of way. So it's a hope. Apocalypticism sometimes employs major figures from the Old Testament, like Moses or Abraham, and it speaks in very figurative and symbolic ways, as you can see there. But the main aim, the main purpose of these of this apocalyptic literature was to put out there the hope and the expectation that God will yet in the future revive prophecy, will once again speak to us in this authoritative manner, and we can project or expect or help to make that possible by showing our zeal and our concern for this future day. So the book of Revelation falls in line in that expectation. It has clear apocalyptic elements, suggesting that there will come a time when the seals will be broken, when God will begin to manifest His authority and bring to fulfillment His divine plan in this world. Israel will be vindicated. God's people will come forth and shine like a light in the darkness, and God will reign supreme. Amen to that, right? So the book of Revelation is written in the form of an epistle, a letter, but the content of the book of Revelation is both prophetic and apocalyptic. So it's an amalgam. It's like a combination of all of these things all rolled up into one. Next. Well, I'd like to talk about the four approaches to interpreting the book of Revelation. And I'll let you know right here and right now what I'm attempting to do. Many of you will walk away and never come back because you'll think this guy is crazy. But what I'm going to try to do as we actually get into the book of Revelation, I'm going to try to offer a parallel interpretation of the way these four approaches have generally understood the book of Revelation. Okay? So let's talk about each of these approaches here just briefly, and then I'll tell you what I will try to do as we continue to move forward. All right? Let's look at the first one. The first would be the preterist approach. So let's talk about the preterist approach first of all. This is the approach that takes the book of Revelation and believes or considers that the book refers to events fulfilled in the first century. Okay? That is, in and around the time of the destruction of the temple in AD 70. So that all the figurative, all the symbolic elements in the book of Revelation do not refer to some future event from our perspective here, but refer to events that would have taken place in and around the time that the book was written. If the book was written in the middle 60s, then up until 70, let's say, then it refers to situations and conditions that were taking place in the context of Jerusalem in and around that time. So a preterist then believes that the bulk of the book of Revelation can be interpreted in the light of the Roman Empire and their decision to sack Jerusalem and to destroy the temple in AD 70. The book of Josephus would be very, very important in teasing out some of these ideas and interpretations. If you're a preterist, then its primary value is historical, because what you try to do is to see the way in which these things are being depicted, and you try to connect those images, those images that you see in the book of Revelation, to some historical situation, some famine that was happening in Jerusalem at the time that the Roman Empire was destroying the city, or connected to some event that was happening in and around that time. The primary value is historical, okay? But it also has a didactic, a teaching function, because it shows us, it encourages us to remain faithful to God in the midst of trials. It isn't that it doesn't have a value for us, those of us who live 2,000 years after the fact. It can have an inspirational value to us, but its primary interpretive focus was for Christians living in Judea, in and around the destruction of the temple around 70 AD. Okay? That's the preterist approach. Next. Then there's the historicist approach. The historicist approach really kind of came about at the time of the Reformation and moving forward, but it became very popular, and basically it provides a panoramic view of church history. The book of Revelation deals with different and distinct dispensations or eras, if you will, with that start at the beginning of the church and consecutively or subsequently move forward until you get to the last day when God wraps up history and we enter into the eternal state. Look at the image that we have there, and you can see that that history is broken up into one, two, three, into seven different parts, or seven or eight, nine parts, coinciding with different times in church history. And the historicist then tries to lay out the book of Revelation chronologically. The problem with the historicist is that he or she is time-bound themselves. For example, if you're living in the 1800s, you're going to tend to see that last period in church history as your day and time. But what if the church continues to live for another 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 years, right? Well, I would think that that this historicist approach needs to be reevaluated and reshuffled, if you will, as time continues to move forward. Historicists believe that Revelation 2 and 3, many, not all, but they see it as depicting specific eras in church history as well. Thus, there is a clear dispensational kind of perspective at work here. And we'll talk more about dispensationalism as we actually get into the discussion of the letter. Its value is historical, Okay? Because a historicist will try to connect the drama happening in the book with historical events, like the rise of the Reformation or the rise of Islam, World War I or World War II, or Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, they will find a way to connect the events, the images that we find in the book of Revelation with actual historical occurrences and try to line them up chronologically in that way. The historicist approach. The next approach is the futurist approach. The futurist approach sees Revelations 1, 2, and 3 as perhaps contemporary events at the time of the writing of the book. But by and large, everything that comes after chapter 3, that is chapter 4, all the way to the end of the book of Revelation, as talking about things that are yet to happen. So most futurists reject out and out the preterist perspective. Okay? This isn't talking about things that happened when Jerusalem was destroyed, when the temple was destroyed by the Romans. It's talking about some future event in the distant future. Okay? And most futurists would say that even today, in the year, in 21st century, we haven't yet arrived at that moment in history when a lot of this will begin to take place either. Its primary value is for people living during the tribulation period. And if you are a bona fide futurist, then you also believe that our interpretations of these things must necessarily be tentative because they're for a future date. And until we arrive at that date, we can't know for certain that this is exactly how this particular, how something is to be particularly interpreted. When we get to that point, those living at that time or near that time will be able to see with a clear focus and will be able to understand the meaning of the apocalypse in a way that perhaps we can't today, because it's still for a future day. So it's primarily written perhaps to comfort believers during the tribulation period, primarily, but that isn't to say that it doesn't have value for us today. We can still learn, we can still study it, and gain much insight from it, which is what we will attempt to do as we continue to move along. That would be the futurist perspective. And then the fourth one would be the idealist perspective. An idealist doesn't try to pin the book of Revelation to a chronological framework, but believes that that the book of Revelation is really a grand drama that puts forth godly principles that are perennially always at work, like good versus evil, the sovereignty of God, the faithfulness of God's promises. These are things that the church has always trusted in, and the book of Revelation isn't there to set out a historical pattern for what will happen in some sequence of events, but it puts out dramatic images and pictures and ideas for us to try to understand what kind of principles are at work at any point in time. So Revelation is applicable to any age, and this view is generally associated with amillennialism. Okay? So those are the four perspectives. The preterist, Revelation ought to be interpreted in the context of the mid-60s onto the 70s of the first century. The historicist, the book of Revelation reels out church history from start to finish. The futurist looks forward to some future event, and only when you arrive at that event will you be able to understand what the book of Revelation is all about. And the idealist doesn't connect it to history in any way whatsoever, other than to say it's always applicable. All of it is always applicable. So, for example, the mark of the beast doesn't refer to some future person. It refers to a principle that is constantly at work in this world. Okay? It was true in the first century, second, third, fourth, fifth, all the way to the 21st century. All right. Those are the four perspectives. Let's move on to the next. Let me just, let me talk very briefly about the historical development of the four approaches. Early on, the church tended to be futuristic, tended to read the book of Revelation with an eye to what God was saying about the future. However, Augustine, Origen, Clement of Alexandria, along with others, these were post-Nicene church fathers, they tended to take or to pick up an allegorical kind of approach, which was an ad hoc kind of way of interpreting the book of Revelation with no real hermeneutical boundaries or limitations. And that, by and large, became the way that the book of Revelation was interpreted all the way through the Reformation, okay? Kind of allegorizing the book of Revelation. It's when we get to the Reformation in the 16th century that the historicist perspective enters into the picture. Okay, this idea of unfolding or unveiling church history. Martin Luther, along with other reformers, tended to interpret the book of Revelation in that way. And Luther, for example, was one of the earliest ones to believe then that the Pope, for example, was the Antichrist depicted in the book of Revelation. Well, not surprisingly, Francisco Ribera, who was a Jesuit priest and an apologist for the Roman Catholic Church during that same time in history, he promoted a futuristic perspective. He says, no, this isn't talking about the Pope here in the 16th century. It's talking about some event in the future. Okay? Notice, most evangelicals today are futurists, but the revival of the futurist idea was actually promoted by a Roman Catholic who was arguing against a historicist perspective at the time of the Reformation. Let's go on to the next. In the modern era, in the 20th century through today, most Protestants rejected futurism because they saw it as coming from the Roman Catholic Church, believing it was a Roman Catholic apologetic. They tended to accept historicism, believing that the church would usher in the second coming of Christ and the millennium. But World War I pretty much put an end to that. It killed this whole optimistic idea that the triumphant church would usher in the millennium through its gospel proclamation and preaching. And so historicism today is pretty much defunct. You might find a historicist here and there under a rock somewhere. No, I'm kidding. There are some historicists. But by and large, historicism has been rejected by Protestantism. Okay, Darby, who was a member of the Plymouth Brethren, picked up the whole futuristic dispensational idea, but he picked it up from a Protestant perspective and really gave it the kind of legitimacy that then made it possible for Protestantism, and not so much Protestantism, but evangelicalism, to subscribe to the futuristic point of view. Somewhere along the way, German liberalism in the 18th, 19th century began to promote the idea that what we have in the book of Revelation is a series, is a dramatic representation of the principles of good and evil, of triumph over evil, of God's sovereignty, and all these major themes. So even today, this is a perspective that continues with us. Let's move on to the next. So what do we have today in the contemporary landscape? Historicist approach has pretty much been set aside. It's still interesting to study it, to see historically how Protestantism pointed that out during certain times of church history. And we'll do some of that just so you can get some idea of how it was used to interpret the book of Revelation. But here in the 21st century, very few evangelicals or New Testament folks, I would think, are historicists in the classical sense. The preterist approach is still very much accepted. There are many people who continue to subscribe to the preterist perspective, and that will be one of the major interpretations that we will take a look at as we move along. The futurist approach has become the most accepted approach in evangelical circles, and Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth was a book published in the 70s, I believe, that was very popular and helped promote this idea, but there have been other reasons why evangelicalism continues to subscribe to the futurist perspective. And the idealist or spiritual approach continues also to be very popular among those who see Revelation as drama rather than depicting actual historical events. So that continues to be with us. Next page. So common sense interpretation. What are we going to do in this class? Well, I'm going to try to provide a somewhat of a mixture, a futuristic, eclectic approach. Please don't judge me because I do that. Okay. What do I mean by that? If preterism has a valid perspective, I will acknowledge it. We will acknowledge it. If futurism seems to be the way to move forward, then we'll take a look at that as well. Do idealists have a point to make when they turn to these perennial kind of questions? I think often they do. And so we will take the time to acknowledge when idealists have something important to teach us and to tell us as well. Having said that, for myself, I am a futurist. I'll confess that here and now, but I will try to be fair to the four approaches. Along the way, I will give you my critique of a particular perspective if I think it's weak in some area. But if I think my own futurist perspective is weak, I'll try to be honest enough to give a critique of that along the way. So what we're going to do as we move forward in the next few weeks is that we're going to be looking at these four approaches in parallel, but not until we get to Revelation chapter 4. Revelations 1, 2, and 3 will kind of give a one perspective on that, but then from 4 moving forward, we'll give those four different perspectives as we move along. And maybe this will help you to solidify your own understanding of how best you think the book of Revelation ought to be interpreted. Move on to the next. Don't want much to say about that, because if I get into that, then I'll never get out of that. Only to say that the book of Revelation does not quote the Old Testament a lot, but there are numerous echoes through. Doesn't quote the Old Testament at all, excuse me, not a lot at all. There are no direct quotes coming out of the Old Testament prophets, which is itself interesting because the book claims to be a revival of prophecy. But it's as if John is his own prophet, is his own man and his own prophet. He's not relying on Jeremiah or Isaiah or Ezekiel or Zephaniah. Okay, he's a prophet in his own right in the context of this book. Nevertheless, there are themes that come out of the Old Testament that you can hear resonate here and there. We'll do some of that as we move along. Next. There's also what I think clearly is parallelism. There's a lot of parallelism, in my estimation, in the book of Revelation. Chapters 4 through 11, with chapters 12 to 9, most futurists believe there's parallelism there. Idealists see seven levels of parallelism in chapters 1 through 3, 4 to 7, 8 through 11, and so on and so forth. Some see the same battle described in 1614, 1919, and 28. There are also possible parallels between trumpet and bowl judgments, but whereas the trumpets presented in a certain perspective, the bowl judgments which come later, seem to intensify the action all the more, yet still speaking about the same situation. So there is an overlap in the book of Revelation that makes it all the more interesting to try to tease out and describe and understand. But all of this should lead us to be tentative rather than dogmatic in our interpretations. Okay? So here we are. Purpose, key concept, and structure. The purpose of the book, it's stated in 1:1 and 3:22:10, to reveal the things which must shortly come to pass. But what does that mean? We'll talk about that next week when we get into chapter 1. Key verse. Why is this the key verse? Because I like that verse. Okay? You might have a different key verse. But for me, it's this one, Revelation 17:14. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. The basic structure of the book, I believe, is also given in Revelation 1:19. Write about what you have seen, the things that are or what is, and the things that will come after these things. So I think the book of Revelation offers its own outline. Chapter 1 speaks about the things which John sees. Chapters 2 and 3 speaks about the things which are, which is a reference to the seven letters to the seven churches. And chapters 4 through 22 speak about this vision of judgment and ultimate victory of the Lamb, which will happen at some moment. Next. The end. I'm sorry for going so fast. I know that we need to finish before 7 o'clock. And I'm Latino, so I'm always running like 30 seconds late. So I still have like 30 seconds before 7 o'clock. So thank you for your attention. Next week we'll get into Revelation chapter 1. I encourage you to read chapter 1 of Revelation. Next week that's what we're going to be looking at.